Hello, and welcome to NDT Now's podcast game, exploring topics in NDT which affect your business. I'm your host, Mary Beth Michelli. Today's podcast is brought to you by Edify Technologies, the world leader in advanced non-destructive testing solutions designed to always keep you beyond current. For more information, visit edify.com. On today's podcast, we will be talking about ethics in NDT. Recent news about the Titan submersible and the documented lack of NDT that was used on it shows that often greed is placed above safety, and that people in management are sometimes oblivious or willfully ignore the safety requirements, not understanding that there is real science that goes into developing them. And though in my nearly 30 years in the industry, I've seen my fair share of people lying about their OJT hours or even faking their certs, today's guest, Dale Norwood, was a witness to one of the biggest cases of fraud in our industry. Fortunately for our industry and the people who rely on us with their lives, Dale had the courage and the perseverance to blow the whistle on that operation. And last year, he published his book titled Diary of an Aerospace Whistleblower, The Ultrasonic Research Story, which recounts his journey in exposing this fraud. Dale, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mary Beth, for having me. It's an honor to be invited, and I want to thank you for all you do for the NDT community.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
So for our listeners who don't know you, can you tell us a little bit about your career in NDT?
Well, it went by pretty quick. This is my 45th year. My career started in 1978 at Southwestern Laboratories, where I was working in the chemistry department, washing bottles, when I got asked if I wanted to go on an x-ray job one night, and not realizing what they wanted somebody to carry the source. So kind of started there accidentally. From there, at Southwest Labs, I became a penetrant and radiographer level two, worked there until 1980. When in 1980, I went to Ultrasonic Research and Testing Laboratories in Dallas, Texas. Stayed there until shortly before they were raided, and left there and went to LTV, which became Vought Aircraft. I was there until 1997. There I was an ultrasonic and radiographer level two. 97, I went to Parker Aerospace in Fort Worth, where I later became the responsible level three around 2001. And I retired from Parker Aerospace in May of 2021. There, while I was at Parker, I was a member of the AIA NAS 410 subcommittee, and I was the Parker NADCAP representative. Now self-employed as Norwood NDT Consulting, an AS&T, RTPT level three, NAS 410, RTPT and digital level three. I'm currently the responsible level three for Parker Aerospace in Monterrey, Mexico, and Firefly Aerospace in South Texas. And I'm loving what I'm doing. And every now and then I get to speak on ethics at various NDT schools and at companies. So that's pretty much what I'm doing right now.
Sounds like a great career.
It has been.
So can you, I want to sort of jump right into this story because there's so much there. And after reading your book, I really want our listeners today to get a good understanding of what happened and where you came into the journey, where it went, sort of how all of this could even happen, right? Because sometimes it sounds unbelievable that this amount of fraud could happen in our industry. So can you take us through what happened at URT over the decade that you were there, and then some of what you witnessed?
Well, when I went there in 1980, my main job was to X-ray F-15 horizontal stabilizer panels. And ultrasonic or URT had three buildings. Most of the x-ray was done in what we one of the buildings, and that was basically my job for a few years, just simply x-ray these panels. I would get to do a little penetrant radiography every now and then, or penetrant ultrasonic and mag. But what really came to light was, I would say in the mid 80s, we would be asked, some of the x-ray guys, to come down to what was building one and help unload bulkheads for fighter jets. And they would lay them on these big crates, open up the lids, and just stand them up for the ultrasonic inspection that was going to be performed on them. Before long, we realized that no one ever saw anybody doing the ultrasonic inspection on them. You would be called back down to help crate them back up and load them up to ship out. And on the horizontal stabilizer panels for the F-15, had no idea until probably 87 or 88 that they even required ultrasonic inspection, because I was only involved in the x-ray portion. So really what happened was, the level three and quality manager, Bill Taylor, was at that time, we use the term stamping off, falsifying the ultrasonic inspection on the panels. He went out on medical leave. And when he went out on medical leave, Sam Shelton, who was another level three there who wrote all the procedures, came down looking for the template to do the ultrasonic inspection. Well, we didn't even know what he was talking about. And it was at that time we found out that those required 100% ultrasonic inspection, and that they were not being done. And actually, it was a contact ultrasonic inspection. It would take about 8 hours on the panel. Well, he supposedly was doing five or six of these panels a day by himself. So that was the first inkling we got that there was a whole lot going on there. So around about that time, we always had quite a few inspectors, maybe up to eight at a time, ultrasonic inspectors or NDT inspectors. Quite a few were getting laid off. But even at that time, forgings were coming in by the thousands. Maybe the truck driver would pick up 3,000 or 4,000 forgings one day before noon for ultrasonic inspection. And the next morning, they would be delivered back with a search saying that they had been ultrasonic inspected.
That's a lot of inspection.
That's a lot of inspection for one person. Now, what would happen is the truck driver would unload all the forgings and put them on tables. The level three quality manager would pitch him his stamp, and he would stamp all of them and then put them back in the barrels and deliver them. Now, of course, it's been said over the years by a lot of people, and also by the members of the Department of Justice at the time, when we get to that, was surely someone receiving the forgings had to realize that this one guy didn't do 4,000 forgings yesterday. But I'm not even sure anybody even looked at that. They just look at that report that says they all passed. And a lot of people would say, and I've had people tell me, well, you know, it's just forgings. They're going to get machined. They're going to get reinspected. But the problem is, now at that time, the machine finished parts were also getting falsified. And then it got to where many of them were fracture critical parts. So there's been estimated that some years there were 250,000 parts going out the door that had not been inspected. So, of course, it bothered a lot of the employees there. Now, this was a time where there wasn't a whole lot of NDT jobs out there. You know, and people find it hard to believe that you could work and see that and continue working, but you kind of justify that, well, it's not my stamp. And you're being told this is the way it is everywhere. So you justify it in your mind, I think, that, well, I'm not doing it. So a lot of employees would just leave. They find another job and leave. And actually, it was somewhere around in early 1991 that we had a company meeting because we were told that an F-15 in flight had the horizontal stabilizer panel peel. The only evidence I have that ever happening is the meeting that we had, but the level three was not happy, proceeded to pretty much chew everybody out. How could this happen? Well, we all kind of looked at each other. We know why it happened, because you didn't inspect the parts. So we were told there would be an audit. The Department of Defense would come in, and at that time, I guess it was McDonnell Douglas would be in, but we didn't really believe anything would come of that because we were getting audited all the time. But this was the premier lab of many people said in the United States. Very few labs had the amount of equipment that this lab had. It was state of the art. So people just found it hard to believe and really didn't go into this lab looking for fraud when they came in to do an audit. Now, the panel peeling back really bothered me. And I had already, by this time, I had already contacted an attorney in Decatur, Texas, Stephen Wren, who had done wills for my family, and he's a country attorney. And I tell everybody, you got to remember back in this time, there weren't whistleblower attorneys everywhere like there are now. There are attorneys that specialize in that now. At that time, he was the only person I knew to talk to. So we had talked by phone a few times. So when the panel peeled back, it really began to bother me. I was afraid if somebody didn't stop it, someone was going to die. And as I say in my book, I was long about that time. I was at a grocery store one day shopping and bumped into an individual who grew up in the town I did, small town of 250 people. So I asked him what he's doing. He says, well, I'm at LTV. I'm an ultrasonic inspector. He says, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm an ultrasonic inspector at Ultrasonic Research Corporation. And his comment was, oh, that's the laboratory that falsifies everything. And I said, kind of shocked me. I said, what makes you say that? And his comment said, well, everybody in this area knows. And I work with plenty of people who work there. So we believed that it was common knowledge that it was going on. So I decided that, of course, talking it over with my wife, that, and she does mention that I don't go into enough detail in my book of how stressed out I was, but she helped get me through it. I finally decide that, well, I'll stop it on my own. So I confront the level three quality manager, Bill Taylor, one afternoon. And the thing about it was right outside the owner, George Klein, was right outside his office, and he was sitting in his office. So I confront him about, why does everything have to be stamped off? You know, this is the premier lab in the U.S., and he tells me it's none of my business and to get back to work. We have a huge argument. And once again, he tells me it's his stamp. It's none of my business. Get back to work. And then he says, well, I've inspected parts long enough. I know which ones would be good and which ones would be bad. Which at that point, I say, well, didn't work so good on the horizontal stabilizer panel, did it? And that's when he really blows up, tells me he's going to fire me if I don't get back to work. So I I figure I'm getting fired. So I go back down to the building I'm working in, start packing my stuff up. And he comes down wanting to talk to me. And I said, I assume you're going to fire me. And he said, no, we all have to get stuff off our chest. He gets emotional, says he don't know what to do. He said it's gotten out of hand, that he can't sleep at night because he's falsifying so much product. Starts crying real tears. I feel bad for him. He promises me we're going to start inspecting everything. And he does start inspecting some product, not everything, but I'm feeling good that thinking, hey, maybe we can turn this around. And then one day, another individual, James, who was in the building when I threatened to blow the whistle on him, tells me that he says, you know, the day that you had the argument with Bill and he came down to talk to you, he said, well, when Bill came back to this building, he grabbed a portable unit, ultrasonic unit, and started rubbing it in parts and hollered, hey, James, get your camera and take a picture of me. He said, I know how to inspect parts. Send it to Dale, show him. And he was laughing about it. And I said, well, then I realized that he didn't really take me seriously. So went to the phone, called my wife and said, okay, I'm blowing the whistle. And so at that time I called, hung up, went in Bill Taylor's office, told him I had to take the rest of the day off. There was something important I need to do. And I went home and called my attorney. We set up an appointment for the next day. We go in, my wife and I, and meet with Stephen Ream, my attorney. And we have a long discussion about what's being falsified. And he's kind of shocked at the amount of fraud that's going on, because you hear people maybe falsifying small amounts, but when you start talking about this much fraud, they find that it's hard for them to grasp them. So he tells me, okay, I can call the Department of Justice and request whistleblower protection from you under the Whistleblower Act. But he says, I need y'all to talk about it for a while first, because if I do this, say, I'm letting you know that you'll never work in the NDT industry again. You'll have to find another job. Well, I said, I don't care if this is the way it is, then maybe I need to find another job. Yeah. So he calls, we're in Decatur, which is about an hour north of Fort Worth. So he calls Fort Worth, the Justice Department. They grant me whistleblower protection, which basically means I cannot be charged with anything for coming forward. They schedule a quick phone call with me when I get home in the afternoon. So, Assistant U.S. Attorney Eddins calls me at home that afternoon, and we have a discussion about what's going on. He kind of finds it hard to believe there's that much fraud going on, but he says, I'll tell you what, let's set up a meeting up for tomorrow at the federal building in Fort Worth. So I felt pretty good at that time, and then I get to work the next morning, and I decide I've made a mistake. I could just quit like everybody else. So I call the Department of Justice up and leave a message for Attorney Eddins and say, tell Mr. Eddins that Dale called, he changed his mind, he won't be there. And within about 10 minutes, my wife calls and says, what did you do? I'm getting phone calls. Your attorney has called. Call Attorney Eddins as quickly as possible. So I call him and he lets me know. He says, well, I understand you're scared, but now I need you to understand that you have a choice to make. You can either be with ultrasonic research as we go through this process, or you can be with the U.S. government. Which one do you want to be with? So I said, well, it looks like I'm working with the U.S. government for my son. So we schedule a meeting for the next day at the courthouse, the federal courthouse in Fort Worth. At that meeting, there was just, there were just a couple of attorneys. I don't remember, a few attorneys, and we discussed what's going on. And he wants to have a meeting the next week. But at the next week, when we show up, we've got the Department of Defense, the Air Force, Navy, there's 6, 8, everybody's there wanting to hear the story, which I start telling the story, and it does not go over well, because they know of ultrasonic research. They know George Klein, the owner. They let me know that this just can't be happening. I must be retaliating against them for some reason. They don't know why. This is the premier lab, they tell me, in the U.S. Many of them have been in there, went to lunch and dinner with the owner. And so they schedule another meeting for the next week and want me to bring someone who can verify my story. A friend of mine had gotten laid off a few months earlier, and I bring him to the meeting. And so we go to that meeting, and he tells the same story I'm telling. There's still some of them that aren't real happy about what we're saying, but they asked me to start providing evidence, taking notes. They say you can't take pictures, you can't remove any paperwork, but you can take notes of anything you see, what's being falsified. So that kind of gets the ball rolling there.
And during all of this, before you even went to the lawyer, at some point you did speak to George Klein, the owner. Is that correct?
I never spoke to him. I only spoke to the quality manager in level 3. And like I said, our argument was right outside his office when I threatened to blow the whistle on him. So I know that he heard all that. But there were multiple employees at Ultrasonic Research that had already left that testified before the grand jury that they had had discussions with George Klein about what was going on. And the other level 3, Sam Shelton, said he had multiple discussions with George Klein, and that George Klein's response many times was, well, I've hired the best I can get. Speaking of Bill Taylor, you know, so what do you want me to do? Now, it was obvious. We all knew, everybody knew what was going on. But no, I never spoke to George Klein about it. But this kind of started the me gathering information. So I spent a couple of months gathering information. We would meet, and I would turn over what I had. I think they finally realized that there's something here, that stuff is not being inspected. As it moves along, they believe they've got enough to raid Ultrasonic Research. And we have a couple of meetings a week before with 2 DCAS reps. And I don't, it's, these are Department of Defense accounting reps, which we're already a couple of months into this process or more. And at this meeting, we're going over the drawings of the panels they're inspecting and some of the other products they're inspecting. And I'm telling them how long it should take. And these 2 individuals are arguing with me that I don't know what I'm talking about, because once again, they say, I know George Klein. I know Bill Taylor. They're still taking their side. But even now, throughout this whole ordeal, there's a individual named Norman Epstein, who's a special agent for the Defense Department, that from day one, he is on my side and takes my side, as he did when they were basically laughing at me when I'm telling them the story. And so when they leave, he apologizes, and by now I'm used to it, because I find it rather shocking that I'm coming forward with all this info, and it's these individuals that are just not buying it. They just don't believe it can happen. So they set up a raid, actually asked me if I would like to come along. I declined. Said, no, I don't think I want to be there. So they're going to go in at the raid, and they asked me how many trucks they will need, because they're going to take every piece of paperwork and basically everything else. They're not going to move equipment. Now, this isn't to shut them down. This is just a fact-finding raid. So I'm at work at LTV. I've already accepted a job there by the time the raid takes place. And I get a phone call from Norman Epstein, who led the raid. And he calls me and says, Dale, it couldn't have went any better. He said, when we walk in the building, he said, the first person I see is Bill Taylor. And I ask him, are you Bill Taylor? And he says, yes. And I said, do you even know why we're here? And he said, yes, I want to let you know I've been falsifying 90% of everything that comes in here for ever how many years. He said that, of course, Norman says, that just doesn't happen. People don't make those kind of statements. So he was very pleased with that, but he said he felt like Bill was relieved that it was over with. But during the raid, one wasn't a funny story, but during the raid, they went to one of the agents went to the front office where the two front office workers were working. And there was a stack of blank inspection reports with Bill Taylor's name signed on them and his stamp, PR1 stamp. But I'm not for sure that these two individuals that worked in the office knew what that meant, because they held them up to them, Tammy and Al, and said, why do you have these stack of these blank reports? And she says, well, it's just for convenience purposes. They said, well, can you explain? What do you mean by that? And she says, well, that way, when Bill Taylor is not here, we can continue to do the inspection reports. And one of the agents says, let me get this straight. He says, you're saying that he's not here, but you're still doing the report showing that he inspected the product. And he said, kind of at that time, they realize what they're saying, and kind of quit talking at that time. But they didn't think anything of it.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of these places that, you know, there's this sort of institutional knowledge of this is the way we've always done it.
Right.
And that's why that practice continues without people really stopping to think, wait, this doesn't make sense. This is not right.
Right. They still remained in business for probably another 6 months or more. I don't remember the exact time frame, but he's firing, George Klein is firing who he thinks he needs to fire in order to keep the business running. And eventually they're disbarred from doing defense work. And that was the majority of their work. So that pretty much puts him out of business. And that was before any of the criminal charges were filed. But that eventually happens.
So, Dale, I am happy to admit that I was in elementary school when most of this happened. it happened quite a while ago. I'm not a spreadsheet.
Yes, well, I so, it was a long time ago, yes.
But the book was published just last year in 2022. So why now? Why did you publish this book now?
The way the book got started, it was around 1999 when I started the book. My wife was friends, the co-author of the book, Worth Wren Jr. Our kids went to school together, and my wife was talking to his wife one day, what do their husbands do? And so I get introduced to him and we get to discussing the ultrasonic research, and it's his eyes just, you know, he just can't believe this story fell in his lap. Because, see, I was very lucky that, and really haven't heard an explanation of why, but throughout this whole court case, up until this time, I was told by Norman Epstein and by others that, you know, look, when the seal comes undone in this case, it's not going to go well for you. Everyone's going to know you were the whistleblower. And, you know, that's just a bad term. People still the way they feel about it. And so this didn't seem to get reported on. I mean, we're in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex and it's just silence because they're telling me you're going to have reporters at your house. This is what's going to happen. And none of it happens. And because for some reason, it just went under the radar. So I was very happy about that. So we talked to in 1999 about the book, and we start doing interviews for the book and do a couple of years of interviews. And we find multiple stories similar to ultrasonic research, not that large a scale. It's usually smaller stuff. Mm-hmm. But we pretty much finished the book. And then it just dawns on me. I said, you know what? I've flown under the radar for this long. I've still got a lot of years left to work. I can't go through with it. So I go to my co-writer and say, look, I really hate to come to you at this point, but I can't publish this book. I'm still in the industry. I'm still working in the industry. And he wasn't happy about it, but he understood. So when I retired, actually right before I retired from Parker Aerospace, I started rewriting the book. And then probably 6 months before we released it, I contacted the co-writer Worth and said, do you still want to be a part of this? And he said, yes, he was very happy to be a part of it. I didn't know, but at that time he was dying of cancer, and he actually died right before the book came out. But he wasn't happy that I removed some of the stuff from the book, but he understood because we had a lot of stuff in there that from interviews. And finally I decided if I was going to write a book, in addition to just telling my story, I was only going to put stories in the book that had court documents that if someone could go back, they can, if they want to do the research, those mm-hmm. court documents are available. I try to keep names out other than the ultrasonic research story. I just say a company, where they're located. People can look it up if they want to look it up. But, you know, I mean, as far as releasing the book, just to let you know that people find it surprising that I've had a couple level threes, ACT level threes, come to me just from word of mouth. They knew that I had blown the whistle on ultrasonic research and just were not happy with me at all for what I had done. And they said, one of them specifically says, I can't believe you did that to my friends. I said, but you don't understand what they were doing. He said, okay, so they were pencil whipping some parts. Now show me a lab that doesn't do it. And I said, do you know it was over 200,000 parts a year? And he said, no, I didn't know that, but you don't understand the pressure an individual is in his position. And I was just shocked. And actually I had two of those conversations with the ACT level threes. So it really, that really shocked me that he was being defended by people.
Yeah. And people who are, you know, working in the industry, and clearly they thought that that is okay. And
Right.
it's almost like they don't realize that they're putting live people's lives in danger, that the pressure that they're under is somehow more important than the safety of other people's lives, particularly our service men and women.
Oh, yes.
That's what really, really gets you in the gut with this story, is that they're endangering the lives of people who are serving this country. So it was just very, the whole book was very powerful. And I thought that the way that you start each chapter with those court cases of similar stories that are out there in the industry, and those are only the ones that have come to light, that have gone to court, that you highlighted. And putting it all in that, in a book together, really, it was a very emotional ride for somebody who's been in the industry for 30 years. I'm reading this book and I'm exhausted by the end, because I'm so upset about what was happening. And one of the ones that stood out to me, was, and was particularly difficult to read, was this drive-through NDT shop in New Jersey. And I guess it made me think, and I think that one in particular happened right around the time where I was working in New Jersey. So then I was really upset. So how rampant do you think the problem is in our industry?
I don't think it's near as bad as it was. I believe now I can't speak for the oil and gas industry. Mainly I'm talking about aerospace here. I mean, the aerospace industry, I believe that, and it happens being part of the NADCAP task group, I know it happens, but I think now it's mainly individuals who act on their own. Third shift X-ray technician decides not to read images, that kind of stuff. I don't believe it's really from the top down like it was. Like if you read the book, Ultrasonic Research Corporation's biggest customer was a company in Missouri that was falsifying inspections. And Ultrasonic Research got their work. And those gentlemen were sent to prison in Missouri. But at the time, it was a lot of from top down. I believe that NADCAP has helped a lot in this aspect, where you just they can go in to an aerospace facility and look at inspection report logs. One of the Department of Justice attorneys says, I don't understand how an auditor didn't go in here and couldn't see that this one individual was doing 10,000 parts a week, as an example. Well, at that time, you didn't, no computers really at that time. Everything was just paper. So it's not like they were going to say, let me see all your files and start digging through files. But now I think that it's much easier to detect anyway. It's going to happen. There's still stories every now and then. And of course, I've gotten my share of just phone calls saying, hey, I got something I want to run by you on how to handle something recently. So, but like I said, I don't think we're ever, I think it's better now than it ever has been in the industry, but I don't think you're ever going to stop an individual from acting on his own unless you show him. I think everyone needs to know you can go to prison over this, and I don't think they realize it.
I agree. I agree. And hopefully that this, bringing this story out with the all the other examples, is something that will, bring the consequences to light. But so I recently saw a presentation by Dave Sito of UTech Scientific, and it highlighted an inspection house in Japan that had been faking inspections for over 25 years. And these inspections were of nuclear rod containment vessels. And he went on to talk about how metadata, and how it can help ensure that these situations do not happen, because the metadata can record when and where the inspection took place, the calibration of the instrument, and all sorts of other data, particularly when you have the automated inspections. But the metadata is there for any of the more modern instruments as well. So do you think that as technology advances in NDT, we'll see less and less of this kind of fraud? We talked about it a little bit, but and then maybe you could say a little bit about what the industry as a whole is doing to address this.
Well, as far as that type of equipment, I don't know if it's feasible to put that on NDT labs. I mean, we're talking about it, probably a huge expense here. I don't know that much about it, but one thing that the industry is doing, and a lot of the prime aerospace companies have doing now, is defect rate monitoring that they're flowing down the suppliers. NADCAP is flowing down in their checklist defect rate monitoring, although their checklist doesn't go into huge details. They just say you need a program. Some of the primes do go into details. So what they want to do is monitor all your NDT inspectors. And what that does is, if you have part A and every X-ray technician's rejecting that at, say, 15% when you look at the data, but you got one guy who is 1% or less, that signals you to go look at his images that he's reading. Mm. Why is he missing the images? And you could catch something that way. And I know it's going to be harder with penetrant, where a lot of the aerospace companies, the failure rates may be, 1% anyway or 2%. But it does allow you to go back and notice that an individual is not rejecting at the rate that he possibly should be rejecting. And you could catch it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And I do think that if the auditors go in and just when they're auditing, randomly look at some of this metadata to just say, okay, when did this inspection happen? How long did it take? Okay, let's look at another one. Make sure that information is not duplicated. It's not, and the metadata, because it's sort of like on your camera, right? You're on your phone, you take a picture with your phone and it'll tell you where you took the picture, what time you took the picture, all of that stuff. It's all recorded now. So yeah, I do think that's going to be helpful.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a DICOM image for a digital image. It's got all the data in there. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I don't want to give away the ending of the book, which, by the way, listeners, we are going to include a link or several links where you can get the book on our Podbean page. So when you go to download this podcast, you can find all the information there. But after everything you went through, Dale, let me just ask this. Would you do it again?
Most definitely. I would do it again. I would even do it again if I knew what was going to happen and we were back in 1990. I would still do it again because the amount of fraud they were committing needed to be stopped. But as I mentioned earlier, nowadays there are whistleblower attorneys. My attorney did a great job for me, but he was a country attorney who. And he ended up being a judge in the county, great attorney, great guy. But now when individuals see something like this, they go to a whistleblower attorney. I'm not telling everybody to do this because this is, I've had, when I speak sometimes, I don't want to come across that I'm telling everybody to be a whistleblower. I'm just trying to tell my story. Now, granted, what I tell people is, if you see a guy doing angle beam and he's supposed to do three other methods of ultrasonic inspected, you don't go blow the whistle. But when you see this amount of fraud I saw, yeah, you do. And I would do that again.
Yeah. And I think there's a level of camaraderie in the industry to say, hey, I noticed you're not doing this. This is in the spec. Let's make sure we address that, which, obviously you tried first.
Actually, I tried on more than
Certainly
one
it's,
occasion. But
yeah, exactly. But I know that, well, I won't give away the ending, but everybody should read the book because I do think that it's really powerful to have all these stories in there, but this story in particular, and see how everything progressed. And I admire your perseverance in continuing to push this forward. I can't imagine how stressful it must have been that to be still working there for several months and collecting information the same time you're talking to the attorneys. I had to think that you probably weren't sleeping a lot during that time.
Not a lot, no.
No.
I
Well, we
had
really.
twin little girls also, so I was used to not getting sleep, so.
Well, well, we really appreciate what you've done, and we, NDT Now is part of this NDT Tough campaign, and a lot of people, when we ask them, what does NDT Tough mean to you? A lot of people talk about integrity and making the hard decisions in the face of pressure from management and from other, from the engineers and from other NDTers, and still sticking to your guns and doing what you know is right and making those tough calls. And I think you really exemplify what NDT Tough means. And so, from the industry, we really appreciate what you've done.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
And thank you for joining us today and telling your story. And we really appreciate the fact that you've tried to preserve the integrity of our industry and the safety of the public.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening today. Remember to join us every month here at ndtnow.com, brought to you by Edify Technologies. To learn more, visit edify.com.